From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump tweeted today that White House counsel Don McGahn will be leaving in the fall. McGahn has been cooperating extensively with the investigation by Robert Mueller into whether the president obstructed justice. You'll be hearing more about that over the course of the day. But McGahn also played a key role in the nomination of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh and, with much less attention, oversaw all other White House judicial nominations, helping the Trump White House reshape American courts, with the Senate confirming a record 26 conservative judges to the courts of appeals alone. Let's take a look with Sean Sullivan of The Washington Post. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
Good. Well, the Pew Research Center looked at how many appeals courts judges other presidents appointed over the same period of time. For President Obama, George W. Bush, the numbers were less than half of what Trump has done. As some Democrats have been critical of President Obama, saying he didn't work as quickly as he could have. He had more vacancies. But others are saying that Mitch McConnell also slowed down the process to a trickle, and now he's racing them through as fast as he can.
Yeah, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has really been on a years-long mission to reshape the federal courts. This began during the Obama administration when he did indeed slow the pace of court confirmations toward the end of the Obama administration once the Republicans took control. And once there was a Republican Senate and, of course, a Republican president in Donald Trump, McConnell has been on this steady march toward packing the courts with more and more judges. And what we've seen is a record pace, more than two dozen already, and we're not even at the two-year mark of Donald Trump's presidency.
Well, we understand that when you look at all the lower courts, almost once a week on average, the Senate has been processing a judicial nomination, sending another Trump-approved judge to the bench. This according to the Boston Globe, which also done the numbers. Which is this president's and this Republican-controlled Senate's right? How would you describe in a thumbnail who these judges are?
Well, a lot of these judges are people who have ties to the Federalist Society, which is a conservative organization that government officials work with, that the president works with, this president, when he is vetting potential Supreme Court nominees and other court nominees. And these are the kinds of people that Mitch McConnell has wanted to confirm. And this White House, under the leadership of Donald Trump, has generally been in lockstep with him on this stuff.
Again, here's some statistics. Out of the 44 judges who've been confirmed in the Trump administration, only five are minorities, four Asians, one Hispanic. None have been black. These are figures kept by the Federal Judicial Center. Less than a fourth have been women. Obama and Clinton, at this point in their terms, had far more diversity in their appointments. Are there a couple who stick out to you?
You know, there are. And, you know, we see how consequential these appeals court judges can be because it's a very small amount of cases that make it all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court gets a lot of attention, but the vast majority of cases are decided at the appeals court level. This is effectively the last word on a lot of really important things: immigration, the environment, civil rights, gun rights, issues that affect people's everyday lives. Amol Thapar is one that comes to mind. He was somebody who was selected by the president, confirmed by the Senate early in President Trump's term, and he was part of a ruling that upheld the use of lethal injection in Ohio, which got a lot of attention last year. And in the Fifth Circuit, which covers Louisiana, Mississippi, Texas, there was a vote on that panel earlier this year on a gun law. And what was notable about that ruling was that all four of the Trump appointees on that court would have reconsidered the case, would have opened the door to overturning a longstanding federal gun law. And so you see how when the president and Mitch McConnell are putting more and more of their preferred judges on these courts, they could tilt some of these really, really consequential rulings in favor of conservatives, both now and in the future.
And they're all young.
Yeah. When you look at the way that, and this is not something that's unique to Republicans, Democrats have the same approach to this. They look at these appointments and they want, in general, to appoint people to these courts who can serve not just for many years, but for many decades.
Well, there's been some response from the left. A group called Demand Justice was formed to try to get progressives to notice what's going on with judicial nominations. But it would seem that that's too late. I mean, this has to be seen as a huge success by President Trump.
Yeah, and it hasn't gotten the attention that other issues have. But this is something that Majority Leader McConnell, that Republican Senate leaders are proud of. And they look at this and say, here's something concrete that a Republican government achieved that is longstanding, that, you know, cannot be simply undone by the next president, whoever that person is. And so they look at this as one of the biggest concrete accomplishments of the first 2 years of the Trump administration.
And they should. They should. Sean Sullivan of The Washington Post, thank you.
My pleasure.
Family, friends, and constituents are gathering today at Arizona's Capitol to pay their respects to Senator John McCain. This is the first of 2 days of services in Phoenix before his remains are taken from the state he'd represented since the 1980s. John McCain died of brain cancer Saturday. He was 81. This week, we're examining his political legacy, and today we look at immigration. Matthew Casey from member station KJZZ reports that McCain made multiple attempts to change U.S. immigration laws, even though his ideas were not always popular in Arizona.
Back in 2004, Senator John McCain told a congressional subcommittee there was an urgent need for immigration reform. C-SPAN recorded the hearing.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman and Senator Kennedy. I will be very brief.
McCain read out loud from a newspaper story about the conditions inside a Phoenix home where police found more than 150 undocumented immigrants forced to live in filth by armed smugglers. These kinds of situations were why Congress had to act.
You know what the conventional wisdom is? We're going to talk about it, we're going to debate it, we're going to discuss it, and nothing is going to happen this year because the issue is too hot politically. Too hot politically.
A former employee of John McCain says the deaths of undocumented people in the Arizona desert drove him to try immigration reform, and the six-term senator never lacked the political courage to confront the issue.
I remember John McCain coming back to Arizona and telling his staff, both here and on the Hill, we're going to do a lot of research. We're going to do our homework because we're going to introduce a bill. We're going to introduce a comprehensive immigration reform bill.
Paul Hickman was there in 2000 when McCain first tried to tackle the issue in the Senate. Hickman, who worked for McCain for almost 20 years, says his old boss wasn't afraid to lose his political career over immigration, which will be a huge part of his legislative legacy.
And that's why I love John McCain, because he's always done what he thought was the right thing to do. Damn the torpedoes.
In the years after 9/11, McCain tried to pass immigration reform with Democrats like Ted Kennedy. Fred Salop, a professor of politics and international affairs at Northern Arizona University, has followed McCain's work on immigration.
He's been willing to talked to multiple people. He's been a maverick in listening to different voices, but his actual policy positions have shifted over time.
During McCain's second presidential run in 2008, fellow Republicans attacked him for backing amnesty for people in the country illegally. In 2010, when Arizona took a hard right turn on immigration, McCain reportedly waited to the last minute to back the controversial Show Me Your Papers law. Here's what he told the conservative channel Newsmax TV.
I think the legislation is clearly a reaction to the federal government's failure to carry out its responsibilities and secure our borders.
There was also this campaign ad.
Drug and human smuggling, home invasions, murder.
In the video, McCain walks along the border in Nogales, Arizona, with former Pinal County Sheriff Paul Vabu, who says the plan by McCain and former Senator John Kyle to secure the border was, quote, perfect.
And complete the dang fence.
It'll work this time. Senator, you're one of us.
The ad helped McCain win a primary challenge from the right, and then his fifth term in the Senate. In the next election, he survived a similar test. McCain was able to walk the tightrope between supporting comprehensive immigration reform and voters opposed to so-called amnesty by focusing on border security in election years, says former employee Paul Hickman.
But he didn't change his position on the necessity of comprehensive immigration reform ever.
Fred Salop, the politics professor, says McCain's 2010 campaign ad shows otherwise.
he was calling for a wall before Donald Trump was calling for a wall.
McCain pivoted again in 2013 when he backed a path to citizenship for some undocumented people as a member of the bipartisan Gang of Eight. Here he told lawmakers that most Americans wanted Congress to act on immigration reform.
I hope they understand that the status quo is totally unacceptable. The status quo is de facto amnesty. The status quo is 11 million people living in the shadows, and they aren't going home.
The Senate passed the Gang of Eight bill, but the House let it die on the vine. McCain survived another primary challenge in 2016 and then continued to push for immigration reform, even as he battled brain cancer. Last year, when President Donald Trump moved to cancel the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, McCain told CNN it would be, quote, not conscionable to make so-called dreamers return to a country they do not know. For Here and Now, I'm Matthew Casey in Phoenix.
Russian President Vladimir Putin today scaled back a pension reform plan that had prompted thousands of people to protest and had lowered his approval ratings. Putin wanted to raise the retirement age for women. It's now 55, and he wanted to hike it to 63. But in a televised speech today, he said the new retirement age for women will be 60. He didn't change his plan to hike the age for men, though. They can now retire at 60. He's going to raise it to 65. To put these numbers into context, the World Health Organization says life expectancy for men in Russia is 66. For women, it's 77. Sergei Kozlovsky is with the BBC Russian service in Moscow. And Sergei, this is a huge political issue for Vladimir Putin. His approval ratings have taken a hit over it, as we said. What kind of a position is he in, and what are the consequences for Russians?
Well, as you know, Mr. Putin is quite confident. He has quite big support in Russia. The famous figure is 86%. But when this decision was announced, many members of parliament, they stood up against this decision. And according to the polls, around 80-90% of the population is against this decision. And Mr. Putin, I guess, decided to soften a bit this package, but not very much, just enough, you know, to contain this popular discontent.
Well, if Vladimir Putin sees his approval ratings dropping because of this move, does he expect them to rise now? And for him, I mean, he was reelected easily. What does it matter to him what his approval ratings are?
Yeah, as I said, he has quite a big support, but you just don't know what to expect when you announce decisions like this, because it is quite big. It concerns every person in almost every person in Russia. I mean, it concerns even those people who are already pensioners, because they're promised that their pensions will be increased. But in the meantime, their children are deprived of this. They have to work several years more to get their pensions. At first, you might think that this shouldn't concern him because he has this big support. But in the meantime, the officials, they face popular discontent. It could be dangerous.
So you're saying it could be dangerous politically.
Yeah.
For Russians, many of whom are protesting, how does this affect their lives? You say their children may have to work that much longer, a couple of years longer, especially in the case for men. But would their income be significantly less if they have to work versus receive pensions from the government?
Yes, many people who are already pensioners, they work anyway, and basically they have two sources of income, their pension and their salary. So it's just like your average income was halved for them.
Cut in half. And Vladimir Putin says that pension reforms are necessary. What makes them, in his view anyway, necessary?
As he explained today, the usual cause is just like every country now faces. I mean, demographically, people are aging, and it's very hard for young generations to support pensioners. And because of that, you need to increase pension rates, pension age, and also economically. Russian economy is growing, it should be growing around 4, maybe 5% a year, as many economists suggest, but it grows only 1.5 and 2%. It isn't enough. And well, if you don't raise pension age in the near future, you could have a budget crisis.
To what extent is the crisis over pensions and pension reform now, the controversy over it, to what extent has this been caused by the impact of Western sanctions on Russia?
Western sanctions, of course, they have impact on Russia in many terms, but it's quite insignificant comparing to the fall in oil prices in 2014, and this was significant.
So how healthy is Russia's economy now?
From on the one hand, we could say that it's quite healthy because the inflation is on record low levels. But on the other hand, Russian economy has very big state sector, and of course, it affects economic growth and the technologies which officials often talking about. To develop technologies, you have to implement different measures. It should be more than just words.
Sergei Kozlovsky from the BBC Russian Service in Moscow. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, now a cautionary tale about reporter sources. Lanny Davis, one of the lawyers for President Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, has thrown a wrench in some recent reporting by walking back assertions he made that Cohen was ready to testify to the Mueller investigation that Donald Trump Jr. told his father, then candidate Donald Trump, about the June 2016 Trump Tower meeting with Russians before that meeting took place. That claim would contradict what the president has said and what Cohen told congressmen in hearing. Lanny Davis also said that Cohen had information showing Trump knew about Russian hacking of DNC emails in advance. Now Lanny Davis says he's no longer sure of either of those claims. Davis says he was the anonymous source for the bombshell CNN report from three reporters, including Watergate legend Carl Bernstein, that Cohen saw Trump talking to his son about the Russian meeting. CNN is still standing by that story despite Davis taking it back. They say they have other sources, but it's particularly sensitive because President Trump already thinks CNN is fake news. NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik is here. Hi, David.
Hey, Robin.
So Lanny Davis didn't come out until 3 weeks after that CNN report with, you know, his take back. He didn't come out until Cohen made his plea deal. What do you speculate happened here?
Well, he was flushed out by BuzzFeed, which was reporting about this and was going to identify him as the source behind the report in CNN and in subsequently matched by NBC News, The Washington Post, and undoubtedly others. The problem behind all this was that Cohen had previously testified to the Congressional Intelligence Committee, Senate Intelligence Committee anyway, another congressional committee, that he had no prior knowledge of this, despite the fact that Lanny Davis was behind the scenes saying that Cohen was present when Don Jr. told his father, then candidate Trump, about this meeting ahead of time. The president, of course, had denied that he had the previous knowledge. So this is, you know, we're awash in the question of do you have knowledgeable and reliable sources, or in this case, as it turns out, an unreliable narrator.
Well, and it's unbelievable that this particular narrator, Lanny Davis, would not have thought that through, because we're hearing that, you know, lawmakers were coming to the rest of the legal team and saying, oh, really? You are going to tell Mueller something you didn't tell us? Here's Lanny Davis speaking with CNN's John Berman last week. Let's listen.
Is it your understanding now that the Senate has been told, no, Michael Cohen stands by his testimony, he did not know of the Trump Tower meeting beforehand?
That's correct. And the reporting was a bit garbled. We take a good amount of responsibility under the difficulties of facing a criminal investigation and not being able to explain or correct or straighten things out.
So David Folkenflik, your thoughts more on what this tells us about sources and on CNN not pulling back their report because they say they have other sources.
Well, CNN, you know, has done some work to clarify what its stance is. It's not utterly satisfying. It says it has other sources. It also points the language of the original piece saying is willing to testify that he, you know, basically contends that he alleges, you know, that these are things put in the voice and mind of Cohen, as opposed to that these are factually true statements. That is, that CNN's saying, hey, we didn't report that this happened. We report that he's willing to testify that this happened. You know, it's not fully satisfying because we don't know the nature of other sources. It's why relying on anonymous sources, you know, requires a degree of trust. Anonymous sources can mislead you. Lanny Davis is not only a spokesman for Michael Cohen, he is a lawyer. He was sort of introduced to most of the viewing public back in the 1990s during the Clinton impeachment crisis and, you know, spun vociferously and muscularly for his client at that time. But I've got to say that
Bill Clinton.
Yeah, Bill Clinton, the president at that time. I've got to say that Davis at this point, you know, it's problematic for reporters because he is speaking on behalf on and off the record of Michael Cohen, the president's former attorney, that is President Trump's former attorney. You would think he'd be in a position to know things. And yet, by his own admission, both on and off the record, he has told things to reporters that prove out to be, if not untrue, certainly unprovable by his own account at this time.
Should outlets use him?
I think it's a really hard question right now. I don't think you can look to him as a reliable narrator. I certainly wouldn't use him off the record. I'd put him on the record if he's speaking for Michael Cohen, because that way at least you and your audiences can hold him accountable for the things he says. As an off-the-record source, you can't really do it, and he's shown himself to be not in full control of the facts or a spinner or much worse in terms of what's played out in public eye in recent days.
Look, we have a minute and a half. I'd love to get your thoughts as well on the president's tweet yesterday that when you Google, and he presumably did at 5:24 in the morning, when you Google Trump News, he says the information that the search engine gives you is rigged, that conservative voices are eliminated. This has been a right-wing talking point. There's a documentary coming out about it. There was a meeting, a discussion group about it at the recent conservative gathering of conservatives, CPAC. Analysts say there's no evidence of this.
There is no evidence of this. This is something the president may believe because he saw it on Fox News, which was recycling something that was sort of overheated from PJ Media, another conservative outlet. But there is nothing to sustain or support this. He's, in a sense, working the refs as conservatives in support of the president have done for the news media. And let's not forget, in context of this larger conversation, you know, the president and some of the people who have spoken on behalf of the president have themselves given out information that have not proven to be true, whether about Google or about the Michael Cohen case. And so, you know, the real problem for reporters is we live in a time where at times people who are in a position to know things are themselves telling things that don't prove to be reliable or sustainable. And it proves to be not only the case for the president and some of his spokespeople, but now, as it turns out, a spokesperson for a former ally of the president who's now an adversary in court.
Things that don't prove to be reliable. There are other words for those things. David Folkenflik, NPR media correspondent, thanks as always.
You bet.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The Venice Film Festival is underway, and as usual, it's a hotbed of offerings from directors such as the Coen brothers and Damien Chazelle, who made La La Land. There's also going to be the premiere of a movie almost 50 years in the making from a director who died more than three decades ago.
Rosebud.
Mega clue there. It's Orson Welles. What's being called the last film from Welles gets its day in the sun in Venice. Contributor Andrew Lapin has more.
In 1974, the celebrated director of Citizen Kane told the BBC's Michael Parkinson about the new movie he hoped to finish very soon. He called it
The Other Side of the Wind, which is about a lot of which has been filmed.
That's wishful thinking on Welles' part. The Other Side of the Wind got caught up in legal battles and political turmoil for the next four decades, and existed only as legend. Specifically, how one of our most brilliant and temperamental directors went out into the Arizona desert with a bunch of his friends to make a movie that would tear down the entire cult of personality around film directors, until the universe conspired to take it away from him and keep his team from finishing it. Here's Welles again describing the plot.
It's about the last day in the life of an old movie director.
Oh, yes.
An older movie director than I am. Okay. Everybody will think it's autobiographical, but it's not.
The old movie director is Jake Hannaford, played by real director John Huston. He's throwing a lavish birthday party for himself in his mansion, but his attempt at a comeback movie is falling apart, along with his reputation. One scene shows a meeting between Jake and his young protege, played by real-life Welles protege Peter Bogdanovich. A film critic confronts them about their shifting powers in the industry, while paparazzi cameras surround them like a Roman Colosseum.
Did you know that when his own production company goes public, that your friend there stands to walk away with $40 million?
Yeah, she's going to say that I'm just going to keep on writing that I stole everything from you, Skipper. I'm never going to walk away from that.
Well, it's all right to borrow from each other. What we must never do is borrow from ourselves. Come on.
Wells shot the movie on and off for 6 years, but he was so broke he had to pay his cinematographer with his Oscar statue from Citizen Kane. He claimed one of his producers embezzled money from the production, and another producer was Mehdi Bashiri, brother-in-law to the Shah of Iran. So when the Iranian Revolution hit, the funding became jeopardized, and the unfinished negatives were locked away in a vault in Paris. They were still there when Wells died in 1985. After a legal battle over who owned the rights was settled, Netflix agreed last year to fund the restoration and editing of the film, clearing a path to its release. When it premieres this week, The Other Side of the Wind will be the end of a saga so convoluted that Wells himself could have been directing it from his grave. In 1975, Bogdanovich described shooting a scene from the movie during an American Film Institute tribute to Wells. He could have been describing the director's entire career.
Orson was all the way across the roof with the camera, and I was at the far end, and he yelled out to me, "Peter, quick, run across the room, the roof." And I said, "Okay, Orson, why am I running across the roof?" And he said, "I'll tell you when you get here."
Will seeing The Other Side of the Wind after all these years be worth the wait? Orson Welles will tell us when we get there. For Here and Now, I'm Andrew Lapin.
Orson Welles' The Other Side of the Wind opens in Venice tomorrow. It'll have its North American premiere on Saturday at the Telluride Film Festival.
Now there is a new thing. Plastic surgeons call it Snapchat dysmorphia. People asking for cosmetic surgery to look more like they do after they use technology to change their looks for their selfies. It's the modern-day version of airbrushing, which stars have always had access to. But now mere mortals are getting addicted to these enhanced versions of themselves. They want the big doe eyes, the freckleless skin they can get through filters. Take Lucy O'Grady. Last year on the British TV program This Morning on ITV, she said she'd spoken to someone online once and then met them in person, and they told her, she looked really different from her selfies. It got her thinking.
Are people disappointed when they meet me in real life? Am I actually, you know, not attractive without the editing? On the editing apps, I used to blur away wrinkles. My way to look the same in real life was to have Botox to get rid of forehead wrinkles and crow's feet around the eyes. And then that led to other procedures as well. I wanted to have fillers. I had my teeth whitened.
Well, Lucy O'Grady said she later realized she was chasing something that wasn't real and decided to take a break from social media. The Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, is calling this a disorder, Snapchat dysmorphia. And they say the solution isn't always surgery. It could be a psychiatric intervention. Dr. Matthew Schulman is a plastic surgeon in private practice in New York. Dr. Schulman, Matthew, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
So start with the phrase Snapchat dysmorphia. It's a new version of body dysmorphia disorder, which has been around for a while. Explain what that is.
So body dysmorphia disorder is a recognized mental health condition where people become obsessed about a perceived imperfection of their body. The key with BDD, or body dysmorphia disorder, is that that imperfection is usually only seen by the person, and it doesn't really become obvious to other people. So we're talking about someone who looks pretty good and is obsessed because they think that there's something wrong with them that other people can't see.
There are a lot of ethical questions there, I'm sure, when you go along with them wanting to change something that is really imperceptible.
Absolutely. I mean, as a plastic surgeon, we are trained, obviously, in surgery, but we also have a lot of training in recognizing people with BDD. These are the exact patients we don't want because nothing that we can do surgically is going to make them feel better about that body part because there's really nothing wrong with the body part. So we're very in tune with BDD and try to pick up on signs that a person may have this disorder when we first meet them in consultation.
Okay. And so are you seeing patients come in, truly seeing people come in who are seeing themselves in these filtered, enhanced selfies and really wanting to look more like that, looking at their faces and saying it's not enough?
Yeah, I mean, one thing to keep in mind is, you know, social media is here. This is what everything's about in 2018. So the filters that are available on social media, such as Snapchat and Instagram, give people a really easy way to change the way they look. And we're not talking about someone coming in with a silly, you know, rabbit filter where they look like a rabbit and saying, make me look like a rabbit. We're talking about people that are using these filters that make their skin look smoother or make their nose look a little smaller or make their eyes look wider. That's the thing that people are bringing into us to kind of show us what they want to look like, which on the surface is really not unhealthy, right? It's just a way for someone to illustrate to the surgeon what their expectations are. So to some extent, it's actually a good thing and we like it. It's when people take it a little too far and they fail to recognize what they actually look like because they think that the filtered appearance is their real appearance.
Right, right. So the American Academy of Facial and Plastic Reconstructive Surgeons says 55% of facial plastic surgeons in 2017, over half, saw patients who wanted surgery to make them look more like their selfies. So what do you say to them? Can you make eyes like those big doe eyes? I mean, we know you can pull up lids a little bit, but can you make an eye as big as a filter can?
You know, when people come in with those filters, if someone comes in, they really want to look like a deer or a rabbit or a dog with their tongue hanging out. Clearly, that's a problem. But there are ways that we can kind of give the changes that they may like, such as a little bit of Botox around the eyes can make the eyes look a little wider. If they bring a filter where their nose looks smaller, that may be a patient that is a good candidate for a rhinoplasty procedure. They're using that filter to show us what their ideal nose would look like. So it's kind of a slippery slope. It can be very dangerous, but there can be some positives if it's used the right way.
Well,
because one thing to keep in mind too is if you think back to years ago, in order for people to change their appearance in a picture, they had to be very skilled. They had to use things like Photoshop and some softwares that you really had to know what you're doing. With Snapchat and Instagram, with one swipe, the average person can just morph their face into something different. So it's so easy for people to change their picture. That's probably why we're seeing so many people using these as examples to the plastic surgeon.
Well, but then what do you do about JAMA's recommendation that, in fact, in the cases of somebody who's blurring a line of reality and fantasy, they've become so attached to their Snapchat image that they're not accepting their own image anymore? I mean, there was one young woman so worried about her boyfriend seeing her in person after she sent him enhanced selfies all day that she was looking for surgery.
So that's the extreme that we're trying to avoid. And, you know, as plastic surgeons, this is really kind of nothing new to us because these are the things like I was talking about at the beginning about body dysmorphia disorder that we're aware of and we look for signs of it. People that come in and exhibit unrealistic expectations or signs of a true dysmorphia, those are people that we clearly won't operate on. And those are people that should be referred for psychiatric evaluation to help them as opposed to having a surgical procedure done by us. So I think you're absolutely right. Those are the things that we should look out for. And in the plastic surgery community, this has been around for, you know, 40, 50 years. We've known about it. It's just now that you kind of add the social media aspect to it and the Snapchat dysmorphia term, the public might be becoming more aware of this.
Well, and so there's something that might be a psychological problem, as Jam was pointing out, and might need therapy and serotonin uptake medication so that people feel better about themselves. I mean, this is what they're recommending, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy and medication.
Absolutely. It's a recognized psychiatric disorder. But, you know, obviously, I just want to be clear that not everyone that wants to change things about themselves has dysmorphia.
Right.
But
I mean,
clearly, we need to define those people so that we can get them the help they need. And also, we don't operate on them because it's not going to make them feel better about themselves.
Is one part of that, there's a woman who's quoted saying that, you know, she had lip injections and some dermal fillers. I guess that's where you inject stuff. And she said, it's my face, it's my money. That's an adult. Is one of the issues you take up, since this is so much social media, when young people come in, they want to change their face because of social media and Snapchat, and they haven't even grown into their face yet.
Those are the people we're really talking about. We have to be very concerned. And as a plastic surgeon, I don't operate on young people. Now, there are people that do rhinoplasties and, you know, nose jobs are commonly done on young people, but there is an age limit. Usually people wait till the child is about 16 years old, so their nose has grown into their face, and we know that physically there's no more changes. And in that situation, the teenager would need to have parental permission. So there is kind of established guidelines for that. Mm-hmm. But no, if someone comes in who's 17 years old and she says, you know, I want my eyes to look wider and I want my lips to be plumper, nobody's going to do anything on that person, nor should they.
Because they're too young. Ethical doctors anyway. But have you said to a patient, a young person who's come in with their Snapchats and said, I want to look like this? And sometimes, I mean, it's not just that the eyes are big. It's that the face tapers down, the body, everything kind of tapers down and slims down. Have you ever said to somebody, I think you actually need help?
We say it all the time. I mean, you know, it's really important to select our patients appropriately based on the physical characteristics and also the psychological characteristics of each patient. So, you know, about 25% of the people that come to me for any type of surgery, I turn down because either I don't think psychologically they're quite right for the procedure or physically they're not quite right. So it's very common to send people away and say that you need help and it's not help from a surgeon and, you know, refer those people back to their primary doctor for psychiatric consultation.
Dr. Matthew Shulman, board-certified plastic surgeon. He practices in New York, and he's speaking to us about the new phrase, Snapchat body dysmorphia. Dr. Shulman, thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
It's hot all the way from New England to New York, tri-state area to Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Washington, D.C. They all have heat advisories today. So we thought it was a fine time to talk about ice cream. Author Amy Ettinger knows it and loves it. She even threw perfectly good vegetables out of her freezer to make way for ice cream. For her book, Sweet Spot, Ettinger deeply researched her favorite food, from old-fashioned soda fountains to high-tech labs. When I spoke with Amy Ettinger last July, I asked her to start off with a passage that shows the extent of her ice cream passion.
I live within walking distance of three high-end supermarkets that carry half a dozen artisanal brands and several locally made pints. I visit one of the shops at least daily, checking on the supply of my favorite flavors. I have also liked the local ice cream parlors on Facebook just to track their daily flavors on my newsfeed. One local creamery has four different scoop shops, but in a nod to Santa Cruz's laid-back style, has an online listing for flavors in just one of those shops. As a result, I must set aside 10 to 15 minutes after dinner on summer nights, just to call around and see which has the dark chocolate salted caramel.
You must. You just must do that.
I do.
So for you, as with for most of us, ice cream memories go back to childhood as a comfort food, a kind of go-to food when family dynamics got too tense. Do you still turn to it as a source of comfort, or would you call it something else now?
I do turn to it for a source of comfort. I write in the book that I got into a bit of trouble in Milwaukee.
Can you tell us a little bit about the story, what happened?
Sure, absolutely. So I went to Milwaukee to talk to the frozen custard makers there. Frozen custard is really a regional specialty. And while I was there, I was carjacked in the middle of the day in a very affluent area of Milwaukee. And it was the most violent moment that happened while I was reporting and researching this book.
Did you still go for the frozen custard?
So I did go after that happened. And then I have a recipe at the end of that chapter called I'll Never Go Back to Milwaukee. You know, the idea being that I'm just going to make it at home. But, you know, the other day I was looking at the COPS flavor forecast where they show the different special flavors at COPS frozen custard. And I thought, well, maybe I will go back.
So your travels and also your kind of academic studies have made you a bit of a scholar in terms of your exploration of ice cream, because you took a class at Penn State. What was that all about?
Penn State has one of the oldest ice cream making schools in the country. It goes back more than 150 years. And they have people there who are trained in the ins and outs of making ice cream. And folks who want to learn how to make ice cream, whether they're big corporations or small artisanal places, often go to Penn State. So I wanted to understand their backgrounds, what they had learned through the training, and to get a sense of what really goes into good ice cream.
One of the things I know you have learned along the way is that it's all about the base. So what is the base of a good quality ice cream?
Base is the milk, cream, sugar, and in most cases, eggs. Some places don't use eggs. There's a Philadelphia style that doesn't. But in most cases, it's the eggs. And it's what's mixed together and pasteurized to create the ice cream. Most places in this country really do rely on pre-packaged ice cream base because they have to.
Because they have to. Why?
There are very, very strict pasteurization laws in this country. So to get a pasteurizer, to get a permit for a pasteurizer is very complicated. And you're supposed to have what they call a clean room. It needs to be kind of separate from the rest of the facility when you're pasteurizing.
So by the way, eating a bad batch of ice cream can be kind of dangerous.
It can kill you.
It can kill you if it's bacteria infested?
Yes, and it has. And before there really were these pasteurization laws and people understood what they were doing, what they needed to do, there were a lot of cases of ice cream poisoning. And we still have that in the country, actually. Home chefs, unfortunately, don't always pasteurize their base the way they should.
So if you want to know if ice cream is really, really homemade and you go to, say, a farm stand or ice cream place around the corner, what do you have to do? Say, do you make your own base?
That's what I generally do. But you'll usually see a pasteurizer if it's there. Places are usually so proud of having it. They're so rare that they display it in a way where you're going to see it, or they'll have some kind of sign up, we pasteurize on site. But I would say 9 out of 10 times, no, more like 9.8 out of 10 times, you hear that, no, we buy our base prepackaged.
So if they do buy the base, they can still put their own signature on it in some way on the ice cream, right?
Absolutely. I can taste a difference in different ice cream shops who use the same base because they have different formulas for how they're doing their flavorings. You can really have your own signature on something even though it's coming from a prepackaged base.
Okay. Can I do a little lightning round at the end here, Amy?
Absolutely.
Okay. Cup or cone?
Cone.
Sugar or waffle?
Waffle.
Jimmy's or chocolate shots?
Chocolate shots.
Chocolate versus rainbow?
Chocolate.
And best ice cream ever in America, says you.
Hard to choose the best. Can I choose two?
Sure.
Or three? Okay. I love Leon's Frozen Custard in Milwaukee, Bassett's in Philadelphia, Kurt's in Seattle, and McConnell's in Santa Barbara.
Amy Ettinger's book is called Sweet Spot, An Ice Cream Binge Across America. Nice to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we talked with Amy Ettinger last summer about her book, Sweet Spot.
And Lisa, I think we might have to clarify that Jimmy's here in the New England area are sprinkles.
Yes, and chocolate, not rainbow. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in Boston, in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.